This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from Brian Lowe Financial. Matt Doyle is producing. Our leadoff guest is Dr. Michael Pasquet, a native of Rain. He received his BA at LSU, graduating summa cum laude in 2002. He has a PhD in American Religious History at Florida State University. And later in the hour, we will be talking about President Trump and his statements about various faiths, including the Jewish tradition. But right now, Dr. Pasquet is here to talk about something else. Being a native of Louisiana, he has a passion about the environment, the coast, and he has been participating earnestly in Coastal Voices, a podcast. And come next Tuesday at the Varsity Theater at the gates of LSU, August 27, 5 to 7 p.m., there will be a gathering of people to talk about this and a cafe, if you will, to present attention to the environment. And no issue is of more importance long-term and perhaps even short-term to the state of Louisiana than the environment. How did this Coastal Voices podcast begin?
Well, Jim, Coastal Voices started in many ways when I returned to LSU about 10 years ago. When returning home, you come upon, you look at your home with new eyes, and there's really no issue, or among other issues, there's no issue facing Louisiana that's more challenging than the coastal problems and issues that we're looking at. So Coastal Voices is a humanities initiative committed to understanding the cultural consequences of environmental and infrastructural changes to Louisiana's landscape. Specifically, the podcast is an audio documentary series that explores the relationship between people, land, and water in coastal Louisiana, allowing people to tell their stories of their intimate knowledge of waterways and lifeways in coastal Louisiana, and also including archival research, oral histories, and interviews with people who know the coast best.
Well, LSU has a great entity in the School for the Coast and Environment, and you are in a different capacity, but you certainly are collaborating with the folks there. And as mentioned, no issue is of more importance. This time of the year, we're bracing for possible hurricanes, usually in Louisiana. The worst ones come either in the last week of August or first week of September. But right now, we have a big issue that is being addressed, but is it being addressed in the manner it should, with the passion and attention it should receive?
Well, you know, in Louisiana, life is punctuated by hurricanes. Those of us who live here, we mark time by hurricanes. But those are moments of attention to disaster. But what we do, what we need to get better at, and what I think as a state we are getting better at, is looking at the problems in a persistent way. And so we have this Coastal Master Plan, and we have people at LSU, we have people at other universities across the state, we have businesses, we have a state government who are in many ways laser focused on the many problems and the many concerns that we have. One thing that, in my opinion, we don't do, we have a lot of policymakers, we have a lot of politicians, we have a lot of engineers and scientists who are doing outstanding work. One thing that what I think we can do better at is think about the past circumstances associated with coastal restoration and protection, and apply those experiences to what we're trying to do now and in the future.
Your number for Talk Louisiana is 877-217-5757. Send an email if you choose to talk@talklouisiana.org. Dr. Michael Pasquet is with us, and right now we're talking about the coast and the environment and what's going to happen a week from last Tuesday.
Right, yeah, in a few days, on Tuesday.
On the 27th, 5 days, 5 nights from now at 5 p.m. at the Varsity.
Yeah, so LSU has the Office of Research and Economic Development sponsors what's called the Science Cafe, which is a monthly opportunity for community members to interact with and learn from faculty at LSU who are doing things science-y. And I'm not a scientist, obviously, but I do focus on the kind of human impacts of the science that we apply to the coast. So doors open at 5 at the Varsity. I start jabbing at 6, and then I'll
physically,
do that.
Physically?
Oh, yeah. And intellectually, hopefully. And then we'll have probably 45, 30 minutes of conversation with the community.
That's wonderful. And WRKF is partnering with you on this, and it's a wonderful endeavor. But there are those who say, look, this is a lost cause, that a century from now, let's give up the ghost. Let's not pretend that we're going to be able to withstand this, no matter how much attention, how much money, that we're truly washing away. How do you answer people who have that point of view?
Well, there are communities that we've seen that have already washed
away.
The
size of the state of Delaware.
Yeah, that's right.
Gone.
1,800 square miles of land in the last 80 years. I made a documentary with a filmmaker at LSU, Zach Godshall, called Water Like Stone, which is about Leeville, Louisiana. And anyone who's driven down to Grand Isle or Fouchon knows that Leeville is against the ropes. And it's very likely that it's a place that will not be inhabited within our lifetimes, or within, you know, some people's lifetimes, maybe my kids' lifetimes. So there are circumstances that are dire. I think in the latest iteration of the master plan, there is an admission of the fact that there will be losses. And that's a kind of that's something new that came out of the 2017 master plan, that is a kind of humility before this problem that the state recognizes. And so hard decisions are going to have to be made.
Now, those who are featured on the podcast, this is something you started, what, about a decade ago?
Well, no, the Coastal Voices podcast series started, the research started about 3 years ago. You're in radio. Podcasts, they can be challenging if you want to do them well.
But you have a lot of voices.
We have a ton of voices.
Who are some of the voices?
So the podcast, you could think of it as a kind of the series. You could think of it as a spatial narrative. And when we're thinking about the coast, when we tell the story of the coast, we're telling a story about the river as well, mm-hmm. And the connections or disconnections between the two. So we begin in Morganza with the old river control structure and the Morganza spillway, and talk to engineers who work on those structures and their perspectives on the Mississippi. And then we make our way down to other communities. French Settlement, we focus there, and that's a story about the flood of 2016. And then Leeville. And the latest one that came out this week is about Fouchon and the working coast and the oil and gas industries and the people who are involved in that. So we've got, in those four episodes, I'd say you're looking at 30 individual voices.
877-217-5757. And as mentioned, Dr. Pasquet will put on another hat in just a few minutes, and we'll talk about President Trump and his inflammatory statements, this time about Jewish people. But independent of the president, right now we have a coastal crisis. And does it matter who the leader of the free world is? Can the leader of the free world make a difference?
It's my opinion that in Louisiana, the study just came out a couple of days or last week or so, where Louisianans understand that the coast and the environment and the climate are things that we as a state can address, but only to an extent. And I think we have legislative leaders, national and state, that are able to cross partisan lines because of the common goals that I think we have here. So there's obviously federal involvement when it comes to a need for federal support, but I think we have the right coalition of politicians in the state that can get that kind of thing done.
Does it have to be a federal and state collaboration?
It has been, and it will continue to be. It has to be, because the problem's too big. Mm-hmm. And we know a lot of our money that's going towards that protection is coming from BP oil spill money and things like that, which isn't sustainable. There have to be larger, more sustainable responses.
As you stated, though, Dr. Pasquet, the state has lost 1,800 square miles in 80 years, and that's with some people paying a lot of attention to this, talking about it, and actually investing in protection, but we're still losing ground. How do we stop that?
We're not going to stop the ground from being lost. It will. It's going to continue. It's about mitigation. And I think as a state that we've recognized that we're not going to have what we had 100 years ago or 50 years ago or even the day before Katrina. I think that is a I think it's just being able to say that is an important first step. And we took that step a while back. For example, in 2006, when we were celebrating the life of Governor Blanco, when she, in response to Hurricane Katrina and Rita, started the CPRA, that is that's started our way towards building a kind of coalition that's a combined collaborative effort to face these issues.
Well, Coastal Voices is a humanities initiative committed to understanding the cultural consequences of environmental changes, changes to Louisiana's endangered landscape. And you can contact Dr. Pasquet on this matter at coastalvoices@lsu.edu. And a reminder that come next Tuesday, 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Varsity Theater, there will be a science cafe in which Dr. Pasquet will be on stage. And we'll be talking about this existential challenge that the state and our people have moving forward in the not-too-distant future. When we return, we'll talk about what's going on with our president and his latest statements about Jewish people and politics. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Once again, your number, 877-217-5757. Matt Doyle is producing, and the President of the United States continues to stir the pot. And the latest target is Jewish Democrats. Here's the President a few days ago commenting on politics and the Jewish tradition.
I think any Jewish people that vote for a Democrat, I think it shows either a total lack of knowledge or great disloyalty.
And on the campaign trail in 2015, President Trump, then candidate Trump, told Jewish Republicans that you're not going to support me because I don't want your money. The president makes inflammatory statements about many people, but this time around he has been denounced even by some of his supporters. With us to talk about this, our Victor Saxe, former president of B'nai Israel Synagogue here in Baton Rouge and a former political scientist at the University of Louisiana Lafayette. Dr. Saxe will be speaking on behalf of himself, not the synagogue or any other entity he is involved with. And Dr. Michael Pasquet from Raine, Louisiana, who has a PhD in religious studies and is associate professor of religious studies and history at LSU, is with us as well. Dr. Saxe, your thoughts about the president's remarks?
Well, obviously, it's a truly horrible thing that he said. It's the kind of racist statement that, unfortunately, has become all too commonplace with the Trump administration. There have been a number of very strong statements made by American Jewish groups which have condemned this statement in unequivocal terms. Let me just read one very quick one. The Central Conference of American Rabbis is the main rabbinic group for Reform Judaism in the United States. And they have said, quote, "The Central Conference of American Rabbis is dismayed by President Donald J. Trump's politically charged and divisive statement referring to the Jews who vote for Democrats." They then go on to repeat his quote and then say, "The deployment of this classic anti-Semitic trope," and let me underscore those words, "classic anti-Semitic trope, should raise serious concerns for every member of the Jewish community, regardless of one's political party," unquote. Let me quickly also add, it should raise very serious concerns, not only for the Jews in the United States, and indeed everywhere, but for every American, because this is part of the way in which Trump makes statements, putting down various groups within the United States in order to build up his own particular group of supporters.
877-217-5757 if you'd like to join Dr. Saxe and Dr. Pasquet on this matter. And the president, of course, makes inflammatory remarks all the time, but this time there's nothing more personal to somebody than their religion, and I think a lot of Jewish people take this as an assault on their beliefs, and it is, of course, reminiscent of times that were present not so long ago in which Jewish people were exterminated for their beliefs because of, quote, disloyalty. What do you think? 877-217-5757. We invited Rabbi Barry Weinstein on this program, and he has been a supporter of the president on how he has handled the state of Israel, but the rabbi opted not to appear today. First time in 15 years of doing this particular program that Rabbi Weinstein has opted out, and I think I understand completely why. But Dr. Pasquet, you study religion of all kinds. Is this an insult to the Jewish tradition?
By accounts of most Jewish Americans, it is being received that way. Upwards of 70 to almost 80% of Jewish Americans identify as Democratic. So already there's a political kind of ideological disconnect with the messages coming from the White House. But also in terms of what Dr. Saxe said, this is in many ways a classic anti-Semitic trope that has been used for centuries and that continues to be used by some segments of the population in the United States. And unfortunately, this kind of attitude towards Jewish Americans persists, and in many cases today it's getting louder and more pronounced, although still I think a minority position within the United States. It still continues.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has steered clear of the president's comments questioning the loyalty of Jews who support the Democratic Party, but he hasn't denounced the remarks either. And a listener notes, this is Amy downtown, stating that Victor Saxe, that the president's daughter is an Orthodox Jew, his grandchildren are Jewish, his son-in-law is Jewish, so why would he be anti-Semitic?
Yeah, actually, that's, and I really hate to put it in these terms, but that's a classic and very childish argument. That's exactly the same thing that you hear all the time from racists who will say, for example, no, I can't be a racist because I like such and so. Ergo, I cannot be anti-African American, or I cannot be anti-whatever. The fact that he has a daughter who converted because his son-in-law is Jewish has absolutely nothing to do with his views from a racial standpoint. And again, it flies completely counter to what he has in fact done. Look, what he did this time is not something that we're just now hearing. Just to give one of many examples, this whole dual loyalty question. When he was running in the primaries, in the Republican primaries for president, one of the things he said to a Jewish group is he specifically referred to Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, as being your prime minister. What he has done repeatedly with every group that is not what he considers to be part of the kind of standard American white Anglo-Saxon Protestant old United States that is what they're talking about when they say, let's make America great again. You get into these questions of dual loyalty, particularly with the case of Jews, but various manners are used to make it appear that they are somehow not real Americans. And that certainly does it as well. You know, really, you know, your loyalty is to Israel, and so your prime minister is Benjamin Netanyahu. Well, I have news for him. Benjamin Netanyahu is not my prime minister.
Well, the president, of course, has been embraced by religious evangelicals on the right side of the political spectrum, and some are saying that these remarks were directed more at them, Dr. Saxe and Dr. Pasquet, than at American Jews, that he's shoring up his base. Is there some validity to that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is something that works very well with that population. As my colleague here just said, Jews overwhelmingly vote Democratic in the United States. To give the example of the last election, in 2016, 71% of Jewish voters voted for Hillary Clinton, whereas only 23% voted for Trump, according to the exit polls. And that's actually a very standard kind of result. Additionally, I should add that among progressive Jews, the numbers are even more overwhelmingly Democratic. The vast majority of the Republican vote in the United States that is Jewish comes from the ultra-Orthodox, which is, for those who don't know, what you might call the equivalent of, within Judaism, of fundamentalists within Christianity.
Dr. Pasquet, how do you see it? Is the president perhaps courting evangelicals more than speaking to Jews when he makes a remark of this kind?
I think that's an accurate characterization of why he makes statements like these. There's a segment of the evangelical Protestant Americans in the United States who strongly identify with who read the Bible literally and who understand Israel to be a part of that salvific, that sacred narrative mm-hmm. that some Christians believe we're heading down. And so it's a different kind of Israel, though. It's not an Israel. It's not a Judaism that many Jews identify as associated with themselves. It's a Protestant characterization, understanding of what Judaism does for Christianity. And so it does ring true to many evangelical Protestants in the United States today, the way in which President Trump describes Judaism or deploys sometimes anti-Semitic statements.
The president said if you vote Democrat, not Democratic, but Democrat, you're being very disloyal to Jewish people and very disloyal to Israel. That's from the president a few days ago. We'll talk more with Dr. Victor Saxe, Dr. Michael Pasquet about this. We'll also hear from Mark Ballard, Capitol Bureau Chief, on the passing and tribute today at the Capitol of former Governor Kathleen Blanco. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Dr. Michael Pasquet, Professor of Religious Studies at LSU, and Dr. Victor Saxe, former president of the B'nai Israel Synagogue, and they are talking about the president's remarks in which the president said that Jews would be disloyal if they voted for Democrats. And Victor Saxe, I must note, is speaking for himself, Dr. Victor Saxe. Jim and Walker. Jim, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. The reason why the evangelicals are so pro-Israel suddenly, because Christianity has been, as a whole, rather anti-Jewish since, well, Christianity, is that they're very much into this whole end times trope. Bobby Jindal went to an end times church. They believe that it's going to be Israel and a Muslim nation or all Muslim nations that are going to bring about Armageddon.
All right. Is that something that is at play here? That's Jim's not the first person to express this, but your thoughts, Dr. Pasquet?
There are, and I don't want to, we don't want to cast a complete net over all evangelical Protestants, but there are evangelical Protestants in the United States who do see Israel as a part, as I said earlier, of this kind of this notion of sacred time and this progression towards the second coming. And for those who believe that firmly, Israel as a place and as a people does play a pronounced role in their understanding of who they are and where they're going as Christians.
Now, Dr. Saxe, go ahead.
Absolutely. This is very strongly in play here. In fact, I nearly mentioned it earlier. This is a theme that we've seen become stronger and stronger in recent decades. As the American evangelical movement has become stronger and stronger, you have seen them more and more identify with the state of Israel in particular. This is one of the reasons why Trump plays to Israel in the manner that he does. This is a huge part of his constituency, and it is vitally important to them that we support Israel because this is a necessary component to them of us getting to the end of times. It's not because they are pro-Jewish. It is because they have to have Israel as a vital part of the play out of events leading to the end of times.
All right. Leonard Johnson writes, Trump and Netanyahu are sacrificing their nations for their power play politics of hate and fear. Leonard continues, Netanyahu came to the U.S. without visiting the president of the U.S., Obama, and spoke to Republicans. 877-217-5757 in our remaining time with Dr. Saxe and Dr. Pasquet. David in Atlanta. Hi, David.
Good morning, gentlemen. I can tell you, President Trump, in my opinion, has shown his true colors regarding his anti-Semitic feelings, and I'll give you evidence of it. There was a radio station not long ago who had a weekly program where up-and-coming neo-Nazis like David Duke were regular guests, and there's this theory that Israel is in control of a worldwide cabal to send dark-skinned people out of Africa into Europe and to dark-skinned people into the United States. Given time, these dark-skinned people will vote and control, destroy those governments, and then Israel could rise up and be a world power and take over the world. And that's their theory why you know they think essentially Jewish people are out to control the world and destroy European and United States culture for the purpose of Israel becoming the world's biggest power.
Dr. Pasquet?
So I don't dabble in conspiracy theories. I do think that there is a fringe in the United States that is comfortable speaking in such explicitly conspiratorial terms. I think it's important for us to also step back and say that while many evangelicals, many evangelicals won't speak in such explicitly anti-Semitic or racist terms and make those kinds of connections, even consciously. But there is, over time, a way in which that attitude seeps into the culture of evangelicalism, and that has an impact on the way in which people see Jews and see themselves.
Dr. Sachse, go ahead.
Yeah, I need to add that this is something that's part and parcel of a historical way that, that anti-Semitism has worked. If you look back to the late 19th, early 20th century, for example, you know, we had, for example, the Protocols of Elders of Zion, which was a document supposedly found by the Tsarist government, a plan for world domination by the Jews. Well, it in fact, was fabricated by the government. Even now, though, that document is heavily promulgated by many of the white nationalist groups in the United States, as are various tracts that deal with exactly what the caller was just talking about, this notion that we're going to, that we are, in fact, a cabal, and that we're going to use people, in this case, African-Americans. In other cases, there are sometimes other players to some degree, but that we're going to use it as a means to world domination. This is something that goes back centuries. It used to be perhaps a little less universal. It would be often within the confines of one country where we were doing such a thing, supposedly. But this is a traditional aspect of anti-Jewish rhetoric.
All right. We have a listener who notes that when these rabble-rousers, and that's a kind description, the people in Charlottesville who were marching, yelling, "Jews will not replace us," the president is on the record as saying there were good people on both sides. Dr.
Very Pasca. Fine. Very fine people on both sides.
Yeah. I mean, there are the most outspoken people who we, I think, can clearly and comfortably call white supremacists. And then there is a kind of softer note that white supremacy can make in American culture that is perhaps more pervasive and something systemic within not just evangelicalism, in all Christian groups, in all white communities, in all white families. And thinking about that constructively and with an open mind and open eyes, it's something that we can do better.
Well, another listener notes that the president has taken aim at women, calling them nasty, the latest the prime minister of Greenland. That's a word he's used at least five times to describe five different women. So if you're not a white male, middle-aged, overweight, you're not in Trump's camp. 877-217-5757, Dan downtown. Hi, Dan, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm wondering if this would be such an issue if, instead of the right-winger Netanyahu, say Shimon Peres was still around, or even David Ben-Gurion, you know, someone of a liberal nature that would be, you know, not trying to, you know, impose, you know, right-wing ideology on his own Israelis.
Dr. Sachse?
This is really very clear. Obviously, I think this is the case. And what we've seen with Trump repeatedly is that, you know, if people are agreeing with him and if they're showing themselves to be Trump supporters, then Trump is a big fan. That's what's happened with Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu praises Trump, and, of course, Trump praises him in return. That's exactly what he's done with North Korea. That's exactly what he's done with Russia. And I'm not trying to compare one leader to another. I'm simply saying that whatever happens, this is the manner in which he operates. By contrast with his allies, if, God forbid, someone says something intelligent, such as the prime minister of Denmark saying, "No, we're not going to sell you Greenland. That's a preposterous idea. Yeah, all of a sudden, instead, this is a nasty person. And, of course, once again, a woman, which makes her much more suspect in his eyes.
All right. And thanks for the correction. It was the prime minister of Denmark. Audrey in Bocage. Audrey, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to go back to the evangelical feelings about the state of Israel. It's always confused me as an Arab American how most evangelicals don't see that most Palestinians are Christian, not not Jewish. So most Palestinians living in Israel are Christian.
Well, that's not actually correct, but that's a whole.
But there are Arab Christians, in fact.
They're Arab, right?
Yeah, and Garrett Graves is one of them, who represents the 6th District. Charles Bustani, former congressman, an Arab American, and the guy running for governor, Ralph Abraham, another Arab American, and yet they have not condemned the president for his remarks. Why has no member of our congressional delegation stepped forward to denounce the president?
Well, sir, I don't have those kinds of conversations with our Congress.
You've been around the Congressman Graves this week.
I keep it tight. Okay. We were talking climate and environment.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Phil. You're on the air with Dr. Pasquet and Dr. Saxe.
Hi, Jim, and thank you so much for doing this. You know, I mean, there are so many different sects of religions and people's beliefs, Baptists, Christians, Catholics, Hindus, Buddhists, Jews, and basically that's the reason why there is separation between church and state and why our Constitution forbids a religious test to run for office. And I got to say, if you called one of your opponents an Arab American son here in Louisiana, that's gonna hurt them. It's none of your business what my love life is, what my salary is, or what my religion is, or what my party affiliation is.
Well, their folks are from Lebanon, so that would be from the Arab world, so it's not meant as an insult in any way. It's just an observation. Go ahead.
If I could go back to the previous question, though, about why the delegation is not saying things that are in any way condemning what Trump is saying, this is part and parcel of what has happened. You know, the Republican Party has been really completely captured by Donald Trump. He has, of course, an 89% approval rating among Republicans. And Republicans, even who disagree with them, and I don't think that's so much the case in Louisiana, where we have a very conservative congressional delegation in general, but even the ones who disagree with them are often very scared to say anything.
Thank you, Dr. Saxe. Thank you, Dr. Pasquet. We'll return with Mark Ballard on the passing and tribute to Governor Blanco. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. The lines are open, 877-217-5757. And today, the state is saying goodbye to former Governor Kathleen Blanco. A service is about to start at St. Joseph's Cathedral. Governor John Bel Edwards will be draping a flag over the coffin of the former governor, who died Sunday at the age of 76 after a brave, gallant, heroic battle with cancer. And Kathleen Blanco led our state from 2004 to 2008. She, of course, survived Katrina and Rita, and she served in other offices, never losing an election, being first state representative, then public service commissioner, then lieutenant governor, and finally governor. In 24 years, 6 elections, she never lost a race. And with us to talk about it is Mark Ballard, Capitol Bureau Chief for The Advocate, who knew her and probably knew her rather well. And for those who did know her, I did not know her well, but I knew her enough to like her a lot. And I think in many ways, Mark, she's like Jimmy Carter. She's become far more popular after leaving office than she was when she was serving.
I think so. And it's the partisan politics that surrounded, particularly her last couple of years as governor, is starting to tamp down a little bit. I think that she'll be remembered much more fondly than she had been right at the time when she decided not to run for a second term.
She is just the 8th person to lie in state at the Capitol. That will happen today. There will be a public visitation starting at 1 o'clock, an honor procession from 12:30 to 12:45 on the Capitol steps. And she is the first person to have this honor since Governor David Connor Treen in 2009, the 4th governor, the others, the Long brothers, Huey and Earl, Dave Treen, and Kathleen Blanco. And Dave was the first Republican in modern time to be governor, and Kathleen is the first and only woman to be governor of Louisiana. And that is notable because, Mark, in the South, only three women have been governors of any state: Lurleen Wallace in Alabama, Ann Richards, Texas, Kathleen Blanco, Louisiana.
Indeed. I mean, she's the first, and I think it's interesting that this is kind of the year of the woman as far as legislative races are going. There are more women than ever before running for legislative races. It's something to recall.
You have noted that in your words in The Advocate, and we could have more women in the legislature, but it will likely be Republican women. And in Kathleen Blanco's day, there were few women, but most of them were Democrats at that time.
Well, yes and no. I mean, there are more Democratic women running, though it's likely that there will be more Republican women winning, if you will.
Right. So. And in the past, African-American females have fared better than anybody else as far as women running for office. And Kathleen Blanco came out of Lafayette in 1984. At that time, she was 41 years old. She had six children, and she decided she wanted to serve. The people of her area gave her that opportunity, and she ran with it.
Right, right. And she basically said, I mean, over time, that it was that, like many women in running, that she decided, she thought, you know, that she kind of shied away from it because there weren't that many women running. And so that was what she wanted to be a part of it. And she determined that since there's not that many women running, that perhaps that, you know, she could do it. I mean, they're all not running together, as it were. So,
well, Mark, that race in 2003 against Bobby Jindal was one right. for the ages. Kathleen Blanco was in a race with several prominent Democrats who were on the ballot: Richard Iu, Buddy Leach, Randy Ewing. They were all running, and she managed to finish second. And she was a decided underdog against Bobby Jindal, who was not holding office as a congressman, and he was running as a private citizen. Of course, he had held positions in the Foster administration, but he ran 188,000 votes ahead of her in the primary. How did she come from behind and win by almost 55,000 votes a month later?
Well, a lot of people have pointed out that she had a more genuine responses in some of those debates, particularly dealing with the death of her son. And I think that's what kind of made it. Now, Louisiana was slightly different, very, very conservative back then, but still leaning towards Democrats at the time, and that also played a role as well.
Yeah, in 2003, Blanco won, but so did Mitch Landrieu, so did Charlie Foti. In fact, in 2005, when Katrina hit, all seven of the statewide elected officials were Democrats because Fox McKithen had died, and a Democrat, Al Ader, had succeeded him. It was 7-7 for the Democrats. Now it's 1-7. So right. It's tough for a Democrat to win. That's nothing, no great revelation. But John Bel Edwards is one who has inherited that flame, if you will, from Governor Blanco. And some believe that he'll be the last Democrat in modern time to serve as governor of Louisiana. Based on what's happening in other races, that might be the case. Does that create a problem for Governor Edwards essentially running out there by himself as far as a major candidate in a statewide race?
Yeah, there's a lot of people, and I'm one of them, that if he was a governor of Massachusetts or anywhere kind of north of I-20, that he would be a very popular moderate Republican, or, you know, and he is basically running against running as a very conservative Democrat in a state that looks primarily at the D and the R behind the name. And I'm one of those that believe that he's going to have a tough row to hoe if he does not win in the primary in October.
And in our youth, if you were a North Louisiana Protestant, that's how you became governor. We elected a succession of them as governors, including John McKithen. But since then, there was Buddy Romer and Mike Foster, but Foster was from South Louisiana. But we've had four South Louisiana Catholics, Edwin Edwards, Kathleen Blanco, Bobby Jindal, John Bell Edwards, and that's a trend that may continue for a while.
Yeah, I think that what we're seeing is a depopulation of the North, basically north of the I-10. The rural communities that had most of the population back in the 60s and 70s, you know, in the small town, rural towns, have emptied out for the most part and moved south to where the jobs are. And I think that we're going to be seeing the Southern domination for a long time. The Republicans have been able to, through redistricting, keep the congressional power towards the north, but I don't think that that's going to survive.
What is her legacy, her principal legacy, Governor Blanco's?
Well, she did do a lot about education. She focused on education in a way that had not been for previous governors. And a lot of her legacy has held on in a way that Governor Jindal also focused a lot on education, but it's still iffy as to how long that's going to survive. But a lot of what she did hold on over time. She also started the dismantling of the Stelly tax rollbacks, and which led to some of the problems that we had in our budget. But I think that you're not going to be able to remember Governor Blanco without remembering Hurricanes Katrina and Rita and now, what happened after that.
Right. And a listener notes, Mark, this is certainly personal to you, but and I don't know if they're aware of the affiliation, but saying that Governor Blanco and your beautiful and courageous wife, Donna Britt, have much in common in the way they have taught us how to fight gallantly through tough odds. I'm sure you appreciate that.
I do, and we had run across Governor Blanco several times at various church events, and her message of, you know, I'm not dying, I'm living, was a very similar to what my wife says, and is inspirational for those of us who do not carry these sicknesses with us.
Well, she taught us a lot. Perhaps taught us more about how to die than how to live, and she lived her life to it the fullest. And as you noted, in 1997, she lost a son, Ben, in an industrial accident. I think he was 19 years old. And she, like most any mother, said she never really got over that. She had five other children and a loyal husband, but that was a searing moment in her life.
It was, and I think that underlined a lot of what I appreciated the most about the governor was she was very human. She spoke what she thought and from her heart, as opposed to checking first the marketing studies as to what would be the best thing to say.
Well, she was quite an ethical person. I recall when she was on the Public Service Commissioner, I was doing a story about one of her colleagues taking gobs of money from utilities that were, of course, managed by the Public Service Commission. And she was, I think, truly stunned that somebody would do such a thing, Mark.
She was a very ethical person. And coming up during a time when we were sending an awful lot of our statewide officials off to prison, she held to it and would have had that total astonishment of, you know, what were they thinking? Why were they doing this? Which I found a good thing.
A person of immense integrity, and today there will be a public visitation, 1 to 6 p.m. at the Capitol. Thank you, Mark.
Okay, thank you, Jim.
Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from Brian Lowe Financial.